This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films The Jungle Book, Criminal, Barbershop, The Next Cut, Colonia, The Adderall Diaries, and Born to Be Blue. I'll also talk about the news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
While there's a lot of news coming out, particularly out of CinemaCon, which was going on this week, you know, stuff like Avatar is going to have four sequels starting in, what, like 2017 or 18 or 20, and they dropped a new Star Trek trailer. There's other things that are happening more important, and that comes from the one thing that I'm really going to talk about today, because I have a feeling it's going to just absorb my whole time, because it means a lot. And that is, I mean, it means a lot to movies. I mean, this is not going to topple nations, but this is a movie show, and I'm going to talk about what's important to movies, and this is seriously important to movies. AMC Theaters CEO Adam Aron said in an interview with Variety at CinemaCon that he would actually start to consider allowing texting in theaters, to removing the no texting policy that AMC Theaters and most other theaters have. And possibly, he said that it could happen with separate auditoriums being denoted as sort of a text-as-you-please zone. Now, of course, the internet blew up all over the place with cinema lovers, like it did in 2012, when the same idea was pitched by Amy Mild from Regal. She did the same thing at CinemaCon 4 years ago and got pretty much the same reaction. In fact, the reaction was so extreme that the AMC Theaters Twitter had to send out a tweet that says, there's no timetable that this is going to happen. They didn't deny they were going to do it, but they basically tried to downplay it as much as possible because people went bonkers, and rightfully they should. And again, this is not something that topples nations, but this is an issue. People go to the theaters for entertainment. You're spending, what, 10, 20 bucks sometimes in big cities to see a movie? Not even counting what you're spending for parking or concessions. And this was all in a discussion for attracting more millennials to theaters, basically teens and 20-somethings. And he said, quote, when you tell a 22-year-old to turn off the phone, don't ruin the movie, they hear, please cut off your left arm above your elbow. You can't tell a 22-year-old to turn off their cell phones. That's not how they live their life. Now, the reality is, it's a lot of people who use their cell phones. This is almost like 60% of people in America have smartphones. I've been to the theaters. I see people texting and using phones all the time, and they're not always 20-something. They're not always a 22-year-old kid. It's old. It's like middle-aged people and old people, all walks of life. It's a rude thing to do. And there are people that are rude, and they need to be told not to do it because you have to learn to play by the rules in polite society. Now, first, I'm going to say something that's actually pretty controversial. I submit that theaters already allow texting in their movies. Why? Well, aside from the PSAs that people ignore while they're playing on their phones, there's nothing being done about it. There's no reporting system. Have you ever even tried to find a theater employee in the middle of a movie? They don't have anyone monitoring this. They don't have any managers wandering the floor. They're in the office. And there's not even a, hey, say something to the manager at the front desk if there's a problem in their policy material. The policy's official, but phone usage is clearly allowed by in the theater chains. They don't care. The theaters don't want to be bothered with that. And if you don't believe me, ask somebody or just look at your own experience and say, hey, in the past 5 years, do I see this happen? I suspect that everybody does. But how often do you see a theater or a theater employee actively do something about it? I've never seen that happen. And I go to the movies all the time. And I see cell phone use all the time in movies, and I yell at people because I have no shame and no fear. Now, quite controversially, I'm all for having separate auditoriums for phone users, because then they would have to do something about people using them in the other theaters, which they're actively not doing. Now, here's the other bigger issue. This isn't about texting. Texting is just a term thrown around. If you think it's about texting, you're about as out of touch as Adam Aaron is when he talks about, oh, millennials have to use their phone all the time. That's how they, this guy's in his 60s. What the heck does he know about millennials? Have you ever watched somebody on a smartphone? I mean, think of yourself. If you have a smartphone, you can't even get out of bed without spending an hour cycling through Facebook or Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, email, texts. This is not about texting. This is not about an occasional screen coming out. This is about a constant, pervasive, continuous use of cell phones that people will do if it's expected of them to do that in a theater. And where is this going to end? What's to stop somebody from playing a game with the sound on, or to stop somebody from listening to a parody video in the middle of a movie? What's to stop somebody from periscoping their own personal commentary about the film, or just pirating the film itself and streaming it on the internet? If you have that open door policy to phones, piracy is going to go wild. Finally, this is not going to bring in more business. It's going to actually drive away existing business, because the millennials, the people that Aaron is courting, aren't going to be more inclined to come to the theater to see their movie if they can use their phone, because they're already doing it, often with impunity. This is the generation that's grown up watching things on computer screens and tablets and iPhones and all sorts of portable devices. This is the generation most likely to download pirated films. Not everybody. I'm not saying that millennials, only the millennials do that, but that's the generation that grew up with this. They already don't care about the theatrical experiences. Theaters are hemorrhaging. They are hurting for money because they're not seeing much of it. They didn't see much of that $600 million that Jurassic World made last summer, or the near $1 billion in America that Star Wars made this winter. They live on concessions and long-running films. And home cinema is taking over. It is so much more appealing. For a couple grand, you can get a large screen TV that is arguably as large in your field of view as a movie theater screen is, with a wicked sound system. And you can control the environment completely. Gone are the days of VHS with 240 lines of resolution, this pan and scan nonsense. There was only one movie I saw last year in the theaters that I thought was a better experience in the theaters than on home video, and that was Mad Max Fury Road in 3D. It was just an exhilarating theatrical experience, loses something on home video. That's one movie out of the entire year. Now, the thing that not a whole lot of people are talking about is, while Aaron's talking about this, the very next breath, Variety asks him about Screening Room, which is that premium price day and date home movie system that John Parker's working on that got Steven Spielberg's blessing. Aaron wouldn't comment on it because, rumor has it, he has signed a letter of intent with Screening Room. Welcome to the end of movie theaters, people. With these actions that Aaron's doing, he's driving people away from the theaters, partly because he will eventually just allow people to do whatever they want to in the theater and there's no sense of decorum. And then once the major releases are available to stream at home, even for a costly price, people are just not going to go to the theaters anymore. You're just going to lose your audience and you're just shooting yourself in the foot. I welcome that. If that's the way theaters are going, bring it on. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Only one that I have time to talk about, and that is Doctor Strange, the next big Marvel movie, origin movie, and this stars Benedict Cumberbatch and comes out on November 4th.
Your work saved the lives of thousands. What if I told you that reality is one of many? You wonder what I see in your future? Possibility.
Why are you doing this?
There are other ways to save lives.
Teach me.
Doctor Strange is a stretch, but you know, they nailed it with Guardians of the Galaxy. Scott Derrickson is directing this. He's got a handle on wackadoodle elements, but also grounding it in gritty reality. Benedict Cumberbatch, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Tilda Swinton. They've got a great cast for this. I'm looking forward to it just because it's something brand new that no one's ever seen in terms of superhero movies, sorcery, and all that good stuff. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Criminal and the Adderall Diaries. Because we can't get girls! Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling into the movie reviews. Actually going to talk about some films. We got six to talk about this week. A lot of small stuff's opening. Some bigger stuff too, but let's hit some smaller ones. This is kind of like a mid-level release, and that is Criminal. Kevin Costner plays a sociopath with a unique brain disorder that allows the CIA to map the consciousness of a dead agent into his head. He must acclimate to the agent's emotions and knowledge to track down a valuable and dangerous asset.
Jericho Stewart. He's in and out of prison more than half his life. He's got no impulse control. He's unable to calculate the consequences of his actions. He has a total lack of empathy for anybody or anything. He feels nothing.
They stuck your husband in my head.
Why?
Looking for details that he knew before he was killed.
Washington, Berlin, Beijing would be graveyards.
There's a whole almost genre of movies that I would classify as covert sci-fi. And these are movies that use some level of technology that's not available now. In this one, it's taking the brain pattern of somebody and mapping it onto somebody else's brain. You can't do that. This is scientific mumbo jumbo. It's nonsense. But the way it presents in this movie actually kind of works. I mean, it's believable. It's like I said, it's still nonsense, but it's not presented as this insane, crazy Captain America super soldier type process. And I really kind of dug that about this movie. I thought that was kind of cool. I felt like I was watching a more, I say more realistic, because again, I mean, it's nonsense. It's mumbo jumbo. But it feels like it could actually work. There was another movie called Deja Vu that Tony Scott directed back in the day, starred Denzel Washington as a guy who travels into the past. Source Code is also like that. There are these movies that have this sort of fantastic element, but it's ultimately just a either a spy thriller or other some sort of crime thriller. Actually, I really kind of like that genre. And I like the setup of this movie in the sense of, wow, what would it would be like? And we see, you know, this is reminds me, there's a book called Hauser's Memory. It's written by Kurt Sadomak, who wrote, or is best known for writing the Wolfman movies back in the 40s. But he also wrote a book called Donovan's Brain, and they made a movie of that in the 60s. The follow-up to Donovan's Brain was Hauser's Memory. And in this book, they basically grind this guy's brain down and inject it into another guy's brain so he gets all the RNA in his head and he's able to kind of become this guy that they transferred his consciousness. It's a great little book and I think it would make a fun movie. And that's what this reminded me of. I always dug that book. I was like, I kind of get into this concept. With that said, and it works as an actioner, but there's some problems with it. The first one is there are massive plot holes in this movie. And I'm not talking about nitpicky plot holes. I'm talking about massive plot holes of something where no way somebody else couldn't have predicted that because it was so obvious. Or everyone had blinders on. I mean, they got the CIA in London, which is the most surveilled city on the planet. And they can't track down a guy who's just plowing through London, committing crimes, punching people, being rude, and I'm not, you just have to track, well, not 911, 999 calls throughout the city. And you should be able to find this guy. And for some reason, the CIA, they can hack into somebody's cell phone from another country, but they can't find this guy in London with all the cameras. The other interesting part about this movie, it stars Gal Gadot as the agent. The agent's played by Ryan Reynolds, but he's in it for like the first scene. But she plays his wife. And I said, this is an interesting one because this gives her a chance to actually act. And I know I'm picking on Gal Gadot a bit. I mean, she's beautiful. I don't discount the fact that she's beautiful. And I don't discount the fact that she could kick my butt. She's not a very good actress. I see in this movie, she's like Gina Carano. I mean, Gina Carano can do some decent acting. She was okay in Haywire. And she was okay in this one called In the Blood or something like that, about her and her husband got kidnapped. It's a smaller movie, came out a couple years ago. I remember covering it. But that's the way Gal Gadot, she's not a great actress. And this was a great example to see that she just didn't do a very compelling job. There's so many problems with this movie that it frustrated me because I kind of wanted to like it. The biggest problem, though, is the fact that Kevin Costner's character is such a sociopath and has no morals. I mean, he just willy-nilly, especially at the beginning, just kills people. I mean, in the most brutal way, with no remorse whatsoever, because he's a sociopath and a psychopath. He has this gradual change where he starts to get acclimated to these emotions and personality, and you're being told by the movie that you're supposed to like this guy, but I still couldn't get to like him. Even when he was doing good, you're still like, yeah, but he's still just the awful person's still in there. And there should, you know, it tried to do too much with the emotion for what was in essence an action movie. So I'm going to have to say Criminal at the end kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Adderall Diaries. James Franco plays a troubled writer who takes a shine to a true crime story for his next book, but he has to deal with the skeletons in his own closet first.
Just had a meeting with your publisher. We love the pages.
All right.
I want to write a new book.
True crime thing.
Writers have a way of spinning things the way they want to.
I came to see my son.
Why? You obviously hate me.
I was doing my best.
You were hiding with your replacement family.
That's not true!
Remember this? Totaled this Mustang.
It's just not how I remember it. Because you have a convenient way of remembering things.
I never read the original book, The Adderall Diaries. I don't know if it would appeal to me, because it sounds to me like that stream of consciousness. Look at the broken person. Yeah, I never get into that. I'm not into A Million Pieces. It's books like that. Something you'd hear in the Oprah Book Club. I have zero interest in that sort of thing. I did find it interesting that James Franco was sort of on the other side of the glass as he was for True Story, which came out last year, in which he was playing a murder suspect and Jonah Hill was interviewing him for a true crime book. Now, this is based on a true story and it's based on some real characters, but there's a lot of liberties taken from what I understand. Again, I haven't read the book. The problem I had with this is, while overall it's competently acted, I mean, James Franco's good in it. Ed Harris is actually quite good as his estranged father. And Amber Heard's in it. Amber Heard's actually had some pretty neat roles lately. I mean, last week I talked about her in One More Time. Surprisingly, a compelling part for her. And she does a fine job in this movie. The problem is, the writing's not that great. The director, it feels like she wrote the screenplay after taking Robert McKee's screenwriting course. He's real famous for giving the screenwriting course. Is he even still alive? Robert McKee? I don't know. I mean, he was in that, they parodied him a bit with Brian Cox playing him in the movie Adaptation about 12, 15 years ago. But it feels like she took the course and wrote the screenplay completely based on that, in the sense of, I have to tie up this story and I have to tie up this story and I have to give service to each one. And you can tell she's kind of going through the motions of all the key elements that are supposed to make a good screenplay, but really don't hold together because they don't organically feel like they fit. And I've seen that before. I've read screenplays from people. I've watched movies. I've watched independent films where you could just tell the screenwriter wasn't writing an organic story. They were trying to fit all the beats that Robert McKee tells them to. And you can't do that. There's a talent to writing and a magic to writing that must come out. Even in hack writing, there's a magic to it. And that magic isn't there. So The Adderall Diaries, while well acted and has its heart in the right place, kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Jungle Book and Barbershop, The Next Cut.
Ooby-doo, ooby-wee. I want to be like you.
Hop-de-ooby-doo.
I want to walk like you. Chip-talk like you.
Chip-choo.
there's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the...
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling through the film reviews. I kind of trashed two of them in the last segment. My apologies to the producers and the directors. The director of Criminal actually retweeted a picture I took of myself with a criminal hat on that the studio sent me. I always feel guilty. I know I shouldn't, because kind of part of the deal is, regardless of what they send you, you have to give your true opinion as a critic. But they sometimes send me cool stuff, and they sent me a neat little hat, a little beanie hat, like the one I got for Cloverfield. But that's neither here nor there. Let's talk about The Jungle Book, which sent me nothing. Jon Favreau directs this live-action remake of the classic animated film based on Rudyard Kipling's stories about a boy raised by wolves who must return to the man village.
Man is forbidden!
The jungle is no longer safe for you.
But this is my home!
Only man can protect you now.
You are a man cub who wants to live in a jungle.
How do you know that?
Kid, I got ears. My ears got ears.
Only I can protect you.
First of all, I'm sorry. I know this is the language that they use in the books in the original movie, but saying you got to go to the man village, that either sounds really creepy, like it's this molestation caravan, or it should be described by, like, Austin Powers, about a boy raised by wolves who must return to the man village. Yeah, baby. Anyways, The Jungle Book was originally a series of stories by Rudyard Kipling, and I believe they did a movie of it way, way, way back at the beginning of the 20th century. But the most famous version is the 1967 Disney animated musical, and that was a charming, wonderful animated film. It was that time of... Disney is a studio, because I think it was the last movie that Walt Disney was really at all involved in. But it was at the time they were going back to a very rustic animation, where you see the pencil sketch lines in the animation itself, in the cells, as they're photographed. Movies like 101 Dalmatians had that. The Jungle Book, you even had it in like the Aristocats, and you had Robin Hood have that. What's interesting, if you look at Jungle Book, Aristocats, and Robin Hood, you had Phil Harris do the voice of Baloo and the bear, and then he did the voice of the Tomcat in the Aristocats. So you had this 60s to 70s group of people who were doing Disney films, which are very different from the ones in the 50s, and are very different from the ones later in the 80s as well. And there's a charm to The Jungle Book that is very dangerous to remake. And I think Favreau did a great job saying, hey, we're going to pay tribute to The Jungle Book, and we are going to have the characters. We're going to have Bagheera and Shere Khan and Baloo and King Louie, and we're going to get some really great voices to do it. And the voice cast is fantastic. Sometimes it's out of the box, like Scarlett Johansson as Ka the Snake. Well, they had Sterling Holloway in the original, which was Winnie the Pooh's voice. It's kind of disturbing as a kid watching that. But, you know, she has a very similar tone to Sterling Holloway, and she works in that, and Ben Kingsley as Bagheera, and Bill Murray as great as Baloo. You've got Christopher Walken as King Louie, which is my favorite scene in the movie. It's fantastic. Christopher Walken owns this movie. And while the beginning of it is really good and it's beautiful to watch, the animation's gorgeous and the action's jaw-dropping at times, and it might be a little intense for kids, like little kids. I brought my 7-year-old, but I know other people who brought like 5-6-year-olds. You might want to be a little cautious, because, I mean, Shere Khan the tiger is terrifying in this. And Ka the snake. Ka in the original Jungle Book is very cartoony. And you don't feel the danger and the peril that Mowgli's in the movie. But in this one, you do, because it looks real. So, you know, just if your kid's scared of the dragon and Sleeping Beauty, you may want to check out The Jungle Book first. Other than that, I mean, it's PG and it's very safe for the family audience. I loved it. My kid loved it. It's a beautifully animated, gorgeously made movie. And they made a very specific decision to not have it be a long form musical, which is essentially what the original cartoon was. And that's fine because there are really only two memorable songs, Bare Necessities and I Want to Be Like You with King Louie. Now, Bare Necessities gets a little bit of play, but it's worked in very organically. The only production number you really have is I Want to Be Like You with King Louie, but they do a great job with that, and it doesn't seem terribly out of place because they are insane monkeys living in a castle. So even in a real-life environment, if there were monkeys living in a castle, I imagine that they would probably be singing. So ultimately, Jungle Book is great. It's a fantastic film. It's one of my favorites of the live-action adaptation. I liked it better than Cinderella. I liked it better than Maleficent. I liked it better than Alice in Wonderland. It's really awesome. It's worth seeing. It's totally worth checking out. Take the kids. It rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Barbershop, the next cut. Calvin's Barbershop is still open on the south side of Chicago, but as the neighborhood gets worse and worse, he and the crew decide to do something to bring peace to the block.
Welcome to Calvin's. If you like it, you pay. If you don't like it, you pay anyway. In every neighborhood, there's a place folks get together to talk about their dreams, to share their frustrations, and maybe even tell a joke or two.
I don't even recognize the neighborhood no more.
I'm trying to get that call in the middle of the night saying my son is locked up or worse.
We gotta fix our problems ourselves.
The barbershop is the pillar of the neighborhood, so we turn the shop into our safe space.
I don't think I ever saw the first Barbershop, because actually it came out before I started doing movie reviews. The second one, Barbershop Back in Business, I think is the name of it, came out in 2004, which kind of made my jaw drop when I heard how long ago that was. Because I thought that it was not too long ago, but apparently it was. And then they did one called Beauty Shop, which was Queen Latifah, meant to be a spinoff. I don't think it was as popular as Barbershop was, but you know, that one was, 2005, 2006. So it's been 10 years before any of these characters got back. They've brought in a lot of the same characters and a lot of the same actors. Of course, Cedric the Entertainer is still sitting there on his chair. And it's got Common, it's got Eve, but they've got some new characters. They've got Nicki Minaj, who literally looks like a cartoon character because she's very made up and she wears these colorful, very curvaceous outfits that make her look almost not real. I mean, her caboose is distressingly huge in a good way. But if it's that big now, what's going to happen when she starts eating and doing less work on stage? It's going to open up like a parachute. She's ready to go crazy Little Kim at some point. Whereas Little Kim was a beautiful woman, and then something happened with plastic surgery because she's like, I'm 25, I got to change my look. And now she looks like Lark Voorhees. So Nicki Minaj, you're getting Nicki Minaj in her prime. But she's not going to hold up like Eve does. Eve looks great in this movie. Regina Hall looks great in this movie. I have a great appreciation for both of them. Okay, enough with the sexist banter about how much I'm attracted to the ladies in Barbershop. For the movie itself, it's a barbershop movie. It does everything it needs to do. It gives you that sense of everybody sitting around the barbershop talking and joking and goofing around. It tells the story of Calvin and how he's trying to keep his family together. It has a really heavy side story about gangland violence in the south side of Chicago, in particular affecting Calvin's family because he's got a 14-year-old son who is being courted by a gang. I have never felt so happy to be white and from the suburbs than ever, because I got a 14-year-old son and his biggest challenge is who's going to drive him home after theater practice. It's so much nicer than having to worry that he's going to get caught up in a gang, because there's no gangs in my area, which is great. And that's why I'm glad I live where I live. But I mean, this movie hits all these racial buttons and racial tones. And I mean, some of them are very astute points. Some of them get a little bit preachy and heavy-handed, and some of them are completely bonkers. But that's kind of what it's like if you've ever gone to a barbershop where people hang out and joke around and talk. It gets a little crowded. It runs too long. But its heart's in the right place, and it actually has some really good moments, not just funny moments, but some pretty tender moments as well. I enjoyed it. I thought it was actually a pretty good movie. So Barbershop, the next cut, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review Colonia and Born to Be Blue, as well as give you some box office predictions and, of course, do the home cinema roundup.
Shake that.
Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's slow it down a bit. I'm kidding. We need to launch into more movie reviews. We got two more to talk about before the end of the show. So let's see what's happening here. The first one we're going to talk about is Colonia. Stars Emma Watson as a woman who joins a cult in Chile in the 1960s to find her boyfriend who has been taken there as a political prisoner.
I'm so sorry they brought you here as well.
I joined up to find you.
It's an entire system of tunnels. There's like a whole secret world going on underneath.
No! You're planning to escape.
You can't see because your eyes are blind.
You can't feel because their hearts are made of stone.
This is based on a real cult location / secret jail in Chile. And this is a cult run by a former Nazi who apparently got taken down there. Of course, a lot of the Nazis left Germany for Central America. And this guy settled in Chile and he ran this bizarre religious cult where they were abusive to children and abusive to their membership. And they segregated the men and the women and they drugged them to make sure that they didn't have any sexual desire. And it was a really horrible place. It finally got shut down. It was finally revealed sometime after the 70s. It was revealed as this awful place. And it maintained operation more as a memorial. And this guy eventually went to prison for being in this business. And he died just, only 5 or 6 years ago. But it's a real place. And that's what this is meant to be. The biggest problem this movie has, though, is it takes this Hollywoodish story to tell a true story. And it's one of those inspired by true events in the sense that it's a real place, but the people who are in this are the ones that their main characters, Emma Watson and David Brühl. He's German and he's from movies like Rush and The Fifth Estate. He plays a photographer who comes to Chile to document the rebellion and revolution, and he ends up getting taken prisoner, and they throw him in this place, and they give him electroshock treatment, and his brain's almost damaged. And his lover, who's this stewardess, joins a cult to try and find him. And you know, Emma Watson does a fine job acting. You know, it's one of those meaty roles. Part of the thing with Emma Watson is I think she still needs to shake the Hermione image. She needs to shake that good girl image. She's still got that sort of timid, demure, polite approach to thing. Even though she's in a gritty situation, you don't feel like she's in a gritty role at all. She just feels a little bit protected. I don't necessarily blame her, but she needs to expand outside of that Hermione character. Like when she did the Bling Ring, she was great in the Bling Ring because she was about as anti-Hermione as she could be. But because she's kind of this prim and proper girl and everyone kind of treats her, you know, with kid gloves because, you know, she's Hermione. You don't want to be crazy. And she hasn't come out with a sex tape yet. So, she's not like Kim Kardashian or somebody. There's a soft touch that she's given in these movies that she needs to either get a meatier role or a different role or something that helps define her. Because this could have been anybody playing this role, and I think a lot of people would have done a better job. And that's not necessarily because she's did a poor job acting. I just don't think she was given the grit that she should have had. David Brühl has more grit in this movie. He's got a heavier part. But these characters aren't real. They're manufactured. They're audience surrogates to get you into the cult and see what's going on. And it's horrifying when you see the stuff that happens in the cult, but it sort of gets tainted when the story gets too Hollywood, when the story gets too much about this couple trying to escape and not about the horrors that went on in this awful place and the crimes against humanity that were committed by this former Nazi. Former Nazi, big surprise, former Nazi committing crimes against humanity. So ultimately, I'm going to have to say that Colonia does kind of suck.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Born to be Blue really quickly. The troubled life of jazz trumpeter Chet Baker is profiled as he struggles to overcome heroin addiction and a career-threatening injury.
We're proud to present all the way from the sunny shores of California, the James Dean of Jazz, the Prince of Cool, making his Birdland debut, Chet Baker and his quartet.
You forget what you always check?
Stop!
No more jazz, junkie.
He's got severe trauma to the neck. He's lost all his front teeth.
28 years of practice gone. He'll never play again.
What did you do?
A couple weeks ago, I saw The Light, story of Hank Williams. And then like a week or so later, I saw Miles Ahead, which I'll talk about next week, which tells a story of this moment in Miles Davis's life where he's kind of on the skids and he's struggling to make a comeback. And now I've seen Born to be Blue. And they're not biopics. Well, I mean, I saw The Light is, but Born to be Blue and Miles Ahead aren't really biopics. They're more a look at a certain time in these people's lives. And Chet Baker gets it's basically he gets his teeth knocked out, and it's very hard to play trumpet if you're used to it without your teeth. And it's his story of rehabilitating and also fighting the fact that he has a heroin addiction, and he's, you know, it begins on the skids of his career as opposed to him on the way up and being discovered as a great musician. So it's a different look. But, you know, these biographical movies about singers or musicians, they all have the same problems. It's drugs, it's alcohol, it's women, and it's bad decisions leading to them having a tough time in their careers. And seeing three of these movies within just the same amount of weeks was a little heavy, and I don't know, it just sort of softened the blow of these movies. And part of it is I'm not a jazz guy. So I mean, I know who Chet Baker was, but I'm not a huge Chet Baker fan. But I mean, I give it points for being an original approach to a biography movie like this. But it's good performances. Ethan Hawke's in it. He does a good job as Chet Baker. I'm going to actually say it kind of rocks. Just barely, because it is challenged by the fact that he has all the same problems everybody else does. But still, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? Last week, I said Superman and Batman was going to win the box office with $25 million. It actually did not win, and it was the first time that Batman versus Superman was not at the top of the box office. It lost quite literally by less than $250,000. It lost to The Boss. The Boss came in with $23.5 million, and Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice came in with just about $250,000 less than that. So they were both under $25 million. That's kind of a disappointment for both, because they expected Batman versus Superman to hold on a little bit better, and they expected The Boss to do better than 20. I mean, it's like the fourth or fifth Melissa McCarthy vehicle that's opened with over $20 million, and that's good to do, but that's not going to last forever, and she's on a downslide. This is not like her opening for The Heat. It's not even like the opening for Tammy, which was kind of a dud for her. That's probably going to drop considerably in the next couple weeks. Zootopia is still holding well. Hardcore Henry did not do well. It made about $5 million. Not a big surprise, considering it probably made a lot of people want to throw up. I saw the fact that they got a cinema score when it was given to the cinema score to people over 50. They all said it was an F. They hated it. And that's because it's an exhilarating, crazy, and fun movie, but it's a little hard to take with the first-person shooter style. Batman versus Superman, It's going into the weekend with $800 million worldwide. It's going into the weekend with $300 million in the States. This movie's going to top out about $350 million. That is a good run for this film. It's don't let anybody tell you it's not a good run for Batman versus Superman. This week, I think obviously Jungle Book's going to win. I think Jungle Book's really got a lot of great buzz. It's got a lot of great reviews. I wouldn't be surprised if it's $70 to $80 million. So let's just split the difference and say $75 million for the Jungle Book. And Barbershop's probably going to come in close to $30. It's counter-programming. It goes for a very different audience. So I think that that will do well. Criminal's, I think, going to be a much lower playing film. R-rated, unappealing hero action flick might have trouble even getting in the top five. But we shall see. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous home cinema roundup. The Forest, starring Natalie Dormer. This, of course, was a movie that came out earlier this year. A horror movie taking place in the Suicide Forest in Japan. It was a neat idea. I think it's cobbled by PG-13 horror movie making. But you know what's interesting? It's kind of compelling. It's a movie that I would watch again. A couple times, probably. I didn't hate it. There's also Heroes Reborn, which is the TV series that was aired on NBC, that meant to be a follow-up to Heroes, did not get renewed for a second season. It's more the same. If you didn't like the last couple seasons of Heroes, you probably will not like this. But if you can't get enough of Heroes, Heroes Reborn gives you, what, like 10 more episodes? That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Huntsman, Winter War, and Miles Ahead. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.